So it is a great pleasure to be here. I have probably never given a talk to such a diverse audience, especially consisting of a lot of mathematicians. My background is in computer science, as Andrew said, in natural language processing. And today I'm going to talk about networks of words and documents. So this is joint work with my graduate students Vahid Kazvinian and Josh Gerrish, with a lot of contributions by many others in my research group. So what is natural language processing? Well, it's in one way to look at it, it's a way to look at textual data. For example, blog postings, news stories, pretty much all the information that you can find on the web and in email networks, financial reports, and so on. So all those things have two things in common. One is that they contain text, which is fairly obvious. And the second one is that they can be represented as networks, which is not so obvious. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. So traditionally, natural language processing consists of areas of research like those, part of speech tagging, recognizing which word is a noun or a verb, parsing, giving some syntactic structure to sentences, indexing documents, summarizing documents, machine translation, and so on. So this is where I come from, and I've been recently, over the last, let's say, 3 or 4 years, been introduced to the field of social network analysis, mostly through collaborations with my colleagues at Michigan, Mark Newman and Lada Damage. So I've been mostly focusing my recent research in those areas. So just a little bit of background. Some of the systems that we have built in my lab over the last few years include the first news summarization system way before Google News. This is in 2000. One of the first question answering systems where you can type an arbitrary natural language question and get a ranked list of answers as opposed to documents that contain the answers. And more recently, the ACL ontology network, something similar to what Andrew is talking about, where we collect papers on computational linguistics and we run all kinds of network analysis and topic detection and so on. So today I'm going to talk about three things. One is lexical networks, which is not my contribution, which is a general area of research in the intersection of language and networks. Then I'm going to talk about two projects that we've been working on. Lexical centrality, which is a little bit older, about 3 years old, and a more recent one called latent networks. So we all know about networks. This is one of the topics of this workshop, obviously. This is a famous slide from Valdis Krebs on books that people read together. On Amazon, you can say, if I pick this book, what other books did people who bought this one bought? And there's a very nice clustering that happens here where people typically read either books on the left or on the right, and very few books in the middle. Another type of network, specifically one that we're interested in my lab, is protein interaction networks. So this is part of a project on proteomics with the medical school, where each node represents a protein, and then you have interactions between proteins that appear together in some reaction or are shown together in the literature. And finally, another example that is somehow related to Andrew's examples from the NRL network, where you have people who send each other email. This was a picture that showed up in the New York Times a couple of years ago. But this is the kind of networks that people usually deal with, email, social networks, protein networks. So we're interested today in lexical networks. So lexical networks are networks where each node is a word, a document, or a sentence, or a query, any sort of textual representation. And in particular, we're interested in the following situation, where each node can be connected to another node by virtue of similarity. So the similarity can be defined in many different ways. One example would be if two words are semantically related. For example, the word cat and the word feline are semantically related. Or if they co-occur with each other. For example, the word cat and the word dog may occur in the same document, and so on. And typically, we observe a lot of local transitivity. For example, if you have cat and dog and maybe mouse, there will be documents that have cat and mouse and dog and cat together. So eventually, once you look at similarity as a threshold parameter, when you start connecting these that are less and less semantically connected, you observe some sort of a global structure. So those three elements here were connected if the similarity threshold was fairly low, but if you raise it something different, then you get a little bit more structure like this. And eventually, once you get it to the highest possible level, you get a fully connected network. So here's an example of a semantic network. So a thing, anything, action, interaction, all those relationships come from WordNet. WordNet is one of the major databases used in natural language processing, which tell you relationship of synonymy, hypernymy, and so on. And what's interesting to see is this is prior work by other people, in particular Soleil, Cancho, and others in Europe. They show that this kind of network has a small word structure. So there are a few hubs, essentially words that have a lot of synonyms or a lot of hypernyms, and then all the other words are kind of attached to that network through short links. Another interesting example of a lexical network is something called a dependency network. This is a dependency parse of a sentence. Each sentence can be represented as a predicate, the main verb of the sentence, and then all the different arguments of that verb. So in this case, we have an action called buying, a buyer, some sort of location or time, and then the bought object. In linguistics, those two arguments are mandatory, whereas some of the others are circumstantial, additional objects that may or may not be included. And apples, in turn, has its own modifier called green. So if you parse a large collection of text using a dependency parser, you would get all those links. For example, apples would be connected to green maybe hundreds of times if you see green apples a lot. So this is another example called the dependency network, where you can also observe some sort of a small word, a hub-based structure. Again, certain words, typically prepositions and so on, which occur a lot with a lot of different words and many other words which only appear in a single context. For example, idiomatic expressions. Okay, so let me now show you something about baseball. Change the topic a little bit. The Red Sox won the World Series. I'm not a Red Sox fan, but I like this example a lot. So last week, they won the World Series. So one of the things that I wanted to see is what did the press say about this event? So I went to Google News and downloaded all the headlines of articles that deal with the win of the Red Sox. And there's so many ways, we have more than 100 ways that people actually said in one sentence that the Red Sox won. So here's a typical example. Red Sox win the World Series, more titles by fall. So maybe that will make you happy. Fans celebrate Red Sox win, so not only did they win, but also people were happy about that win. Now, what's interesting in this is that we have a collaborative effort. All those writers come up with the titles independently of each other because they want to be the first ones to publish. And yet they don't just say Red Sox win. They try to give some additional information. In fact, if you produce a list of all the facts that are mentioned in those stories, you will see that there is some sort of a Zipfian distribution of concepts. By the way, this is the full list of headlines that was given on Google News from different sources on that topic. So this is the list of topics organized in decreasing order of frequency. And again, this is a Zipfian distribution in that the rank is proportional to the frequency, inversely proportional to the frequency. So for example, if Red Sox is the most frequent one, and its frequency is, let's say, 1 in 20, then this one is going to be half as much, one-third as much, and so on and so forth. And you can see how the distribution of facts goes from the really important ones to some mid-range ones. The fact that, for example, the previous time Red Sox won the World Series was 4 years ago. This is the second time that the score was such and such. Until some really not so central information, such as there's no longer a curse.
It's pretty central.
All right. Then the fact that Colorado, for example, had very young players on their team. One interesting thing is that the word baseball is never to be seen because it's assumed, again, culturally, that when you talk about Red Sox and so on and World Series, that people understand the word baseball is implicit.
Why aren't there some word pairs and some word signatures?
Those are topics.
How did you identify?
This is manually done. So we just went through all the headlines and said, does this one talk about the Red Sox? Yes. Does this one talk about Boston? Yes. Okay, so now let me introduce now an algorithm called LexRank, which is used to compute a lexical centrality in graphs. So the basic concept is that you have a network where each node is a lexical unit, typically a word or a sentence. In our case, it was headlines or queries and query logs. And edges define a pairwise similarity using a correlation. And typically, in information retrieval and natural language processing, people use something called the cosine similarity. The cosine similarity tells you how related two sequences of words are. And it's usually modified by something called IDF, the inverse document frequency. So if a word like the appears in two sentences, its contribution is not going to be as high as the presence of Red Sox, for example. So the intuition is that even though you don't have explicit linkage structure between those sentences, there is this structure that comes from the lexical similarity. And then, in fact, the nodes that have the most connections but also are connected to large groups of other nodes are the ones that we could call the most lexically central. This is in parallel to many other concepts in social network analysis, such as eigenvector centrality and path centrality, geodesic centrality, and so on. So one thing that you can do is you can define the centrality of each node as the weighted sum of the scores of its neighbors, and then this is a typical process similar to PageRank, where you have a convergence after a certain number of iterations, where the centrality of each node converges to its stationary value. So here's the example with the red socks. You can see that there's some nodes that are fairly highly connected. For example, word series, red socks, complete sweep of rockets. So this is important because it consists of four or five of the more important facts, as opposed to something like the Red Sox claim word series style, which has maybe three or two of them. Of Boston, the celebration aspect is shown here as a separate cluster. Now, one thing that you realize is that this graph depends on the cutoff that is being used. So if I raise or lower the similarity cutoff, I'm going to get a totally different picture. So one of the goals of this research has been to try and see if this graph has a particular structure, for example, a small word structure, as a function of the cutoff. And it will turn out that it does. So for example, when you set the threshold to be something very low, the graph is so well connected that there is no power law. Then at some point, which typically occurs at cosine between 0.2 and 0.25, you suddenly see the sort of emerging behavior, like a phase transition. Okay, so here's an example of our system called ClareLib, which is publicly available. It has maybe more than 200 pro modules for computing all kinds of network analysis techniques and algorithms on lexical networks. So one of the things that it does is you can type in some text here, upload it from a file, and it will produce this sort of graphic. And you can now rank the sentences based on the centrality. In this case, you will see that each sentence gets a certain score. And then you can pretty much pick the highest ranking sentence as the summary of the whole cluster. These are the most important facts. And then if you remove that node and all the edges that are incident on it, you can now partition the graph into smaller communities and maybe find the second and third largest components of the graph. For example, the fact that there was a celebration, or the fact that this was the second win in 3 years, and so on. So recursively, you can build a summary of the entire cluster this way. And this is, by the way, the full list of scores. You can see the highest scoring sentence by lexical centrality is Red Sox win baseball's World Series title by sweeping rockets, whereas the lowest one just says Boston reigns supreme, which is a very interesting sentence to have. But again, you wouldn't pick this sentence as the summary unless you had a lot of background and you could assume that all the other facts are known to your communicator. And there are lots of other things that you can do. For example, I can acquire synonyms with this data, and we'll skip this part. Any questions so far? This one? This one? Okay.
How did you find these set of words? What are those? What does each node represent?
Okay, each node is a headline that was printed immediately after the word series ended. And the edges connect two headlines if they have a lot of words in common, pretty much. And again, words that are rare count more when you decide if two sentences are related. So words like and, of, and so on would not contribute as much as red socks.
So those set of words, you came up with those manually?
No, this is completely automatic. You just have the full set of headlines, and you compute the cosine similarity between every pair.
So there are no topics then?
Here, they're not topics. Okay. Again, the topics will come into play later when we actually try to show analytically that there is a phase transition going on.
And so, and just so that I can understand that I'm on the same page, and so the task that you're imagining here is that you would say you want to pick the one title that best summarizes.
Exactly, that's the goal. So this is a summarization problem. We have a collection of documents or sentences without any hyperlinks, for example, which could be useful for PageRank. And we want to produce a summary that first finds the most important topic. And then if you have more space, you know, this is a well-known principle in journalism called the pyramid method, where you first print the most important information, then you expand recursively. Then you could add more and more until you run out of space. Yes, question?
So these edges actually have some weights which are dependent on the number of.
Yes, that's correct. So I have another example here. So in the most general case, this is the kind of picture that you have. So each node is connected to each of the other nodes with a certain weight, which could be zero if they're not connected at all. And then if you raise the cosine similarity, many of those edges will get deleted in turn. And at some point, about 20 to 25% cosine, you're going to observe a small world behavior. And I'm going to show this a little bit later in more detail, where you have this emerging structure with one or two of the nodes having the most connections and many of the other nodes having almost no degree of zero, one or two neighbors.
So do you have some kind of an iteration set up on the graph to calculate these weights, or are they independent of each?
No, the original weights are just the cosine similarities.
Okay.
Based on IDF as well, yeah. So I have a formula in the first slides. I'll show you the exact formula that is used. Okay, so now let's talk about natural language processing and network analysis. Now, this is one of the emerging trends in natural language processing, as again, very nicely had Andrew's talk just before mine, as you could see from Andrew's talk. In the last 4 or 5 years, people have started very actively to use graph methods in natural language processing, which was pretty much unheard of before. People before were focusing mostly on syntactic structure, or perhaps if they come from a machine translation or speech communities, they were focusing on n-gram sequences of words and using a hidden Markov models to predict the next word in a sequence. So in natural language processing, I'm going to show you very quickly 4 or 5 examples of where network analysis can be useful. So this is an example of a dependency parse of a sentence, a much more complicated one than the one that I showed you earlier. And the way to read this is that this word here, have, is the root of the dependency tree. It has a certain number of arguments, this one, and this one. Again, it's 3 children, which are sales, bin, and period, which is considered to be also a word in this example. And if you go recursively, you will see that, for example, you have a prepositional phrase here, since March. The head of the prepositional phrase is since. The preposition in March is the actual modifier of the name. So this is one of the most important problems in natural language processing, given a sentence like this, to be able to come up with a structure of this kind. And why is this important? Because then you can ask questions. For example, say, find all the sentences where a certain type of event has occurred, and so on. So here's an algorithm by Ryan McDonald and Fernando Pereira from 2005, where they actually look at this problem as a graph problem, where each of the nodes of the graph corresponds to words. And then you have links that are higher with high weights if that particular dependency has been observed in the training data. So in this example, the sentence is John likes green apples. And you can perform an algorithm that is based on a greedy algorithm that tries to find the spanning tree of the whole graph, such that eventually, once you collapse the nodes back together, you will get the dependency structure. So likes, now is the head, is the root of the tree. It has 4 arguments. Root is the root of the sentence, which is always there by default. Then likes is the main predicate. Likes has 3 arguments, John, period, and apples. So John likes apples. And finally, apples is modified by green. So this is one example where graphs and NLP meet. And very quickly, here's some other examples. For part of speech tagging, you're looking in this case in German for verbs and nouns and so on to appear in the same classes based on the context in which they appear. So again, you can use graph clustering algorithms to identify the parts of speech of the individual words. You can simply do word sense disambiguation. Each word in a sequence can have multiple senses. And then you can, based on your training data, associate connections. For example, was this sense of that word ever seen with this sense of this other word? And then finally, if you use decoding algorithms, so it's similar to the one that we use in HMMs, to find the path with the smallest cost for this, which essentially links the senses of the different words in the sentence. You can also do document indexing by finding the words that appear the most frequently together in the document. You can do subjectivity analysis where you have a certain number of sentences that are similar to each other. And then by using a mean cut, you get 2 different communities, one that consists of factual sentences and one that consists of subjective sentences. This is important for things like a product review analysis and a lot of the blog analysis type of problems. Another interesting project from Stanford is semantic class induction. Here's what they do. They take a set of words that are linked highly. If they occur together in the same sentence, they're not connected with some well-known conjunction, such as and or but. So for example, if cherry and pear appear together in the same sentence, that will give a link here, banana and pear, or banana or pear, and so on. And once you do this, you can actually get a very good idea that apple is a polysemous word, has multiple meanings. One that falls into the food category, one that falls into the corporate computing category. In fact, this is one of our projects from 2005 at the Yemen OP conference, where we have a query, like a user query in a search engine. We know that those two documents are similar. And then we know that those ones are not that similar to the query, so we don't want to repeat. But there's some hidden documents which are connected to the graph to some of the relevant ones, which we want to get to by following paths on the graph. OK, so this is just a little introduction of where NLP intersects with networks. Any questions? Okay, so now I'm going to talk about two particular recent projects that we have been working on where we use lexical centrality and related methods for specific problems. So one of the things that my group is well known for is for collaborations with many other disciplines. So we've had collaborations with people in linguistics, and more recently mostly with people in bioinformatics and political science. And as it turns out, for us, whether it's political science text or bioinformatics text doesn't make a lot of difference. What's more important is that we have developed a common set of techniques which can find patterns regardless of the original. So one of the recent works, which by the way gave us the Gosnell Prize, which is the largest award in political science in 2005, is on, again, topic identification for political science. And we have actually several papers that came out of this project, but one of them is based on an algorithm called Maven-Rank. So Maven, at least in the popular terminology, is a person who's very knowledgeable in a particular topic, sets the agenda on that particular topic. So what we were interested in is, by looking at the data from US Congress, identifying which speeches, again, this is speech in the sense of something that you say in Congress, rather than speech processing, which is a different area of natural language processing. We don't do that. So again, we connect speeches based on their lexical similarity, and then we perform different sorts of random walks on this graph. So here's an example. Speaker one spoke three times on a particular topic, and then those were typically connected to each other, but they're also connected to some of the speeches by some of the other speakers. And at the end of the day, we get some interesting results where we identify correctly all the heads of committees in Congress, for example, Education Committee, the Appropriations Committees, and so on, based on the topic on which they spoke and based on their lexical centrality. So here's an example from Education. As you can see, we have Edward Kennedy, William Frist, who were the chairman and ranking member of the committee in Senate that deals with education, as the ones with the highest centrality. And then you have a day occasionally some other congressmen, congress ladies who appear in the periphery, because for this particular topic they were not what we call the mavens. This is actually for our 2005 paper, where we use a method based on dynamic EM, expectation maximization, for identifying the most important topics in Congress. And we came up actually with a very specific number, 42 topics, and this just shows you how they connect each other using a dendrogram. So the two that are closest to each other are here, debt deficit and employment, they're closest to each other. Then you have some sort of macroeconomical topics, regulation topics, and so on. And finally, the last merge that appears with a very high threshold up there is where you merge the procedural things, like we hereby proclaim today the day of the hedgehog in Pennsylvania, or something like that, from the actual debates in Congress. Okay, so this is the end of this part. And the second thing that we're doing more recently, questions?
How you say a little bit more about how you evaluate that. So part of what I understood you say is that you predicted who were the chairs of the various committees.
Yeah, so the way we actually have two papers on this, and we use two different evaluation methods. In one of the evaluations, we use a more subjective evaluation, where we have the political scientists look at the output for each of the topics and manually annotate by seniority on the committee. And it turns out that we get, again, the chairman, the ranking member, and then finally all the other members by seniority. And we correlate very strongly with that ranking.
I wonder which way the causality goes. Is it that the chair more often gives speeches on this, or if you give speeches on this, you're likely to become chair in the future?
Yeah, this is definitely part of the issue. The second evaluation that we have is based on the actual timing of the different events. So, for example, if you're the most central person at such and such time, are you more likely to become a ranking member or something like that? So that's the more recent one that we're working. Okay, now the second project that is involved with lexical centrality is one in bioinformatics. The goal here is to produce automatically a set of protein-protein interactions by reading PubMed papers. So again, this is a very common problem, and our main contribution to the natural language part of it is that we have a very accurate system based on support vector machines using a very specific kernel called the PathEdit kernel, which I'll explain on the next slide, which looks at sentences like this one. The results demonstrated that KIC interacts rhythmically with KIA, KIB, and SASA. So all those are protein names. And the goal is to be able to determine that KIC interacts with KIA directly, and not with, let's say, and this one doesn't directly interact with this one. Maybe they do, but they have to interact first with this one. So those would be second-degree neighbors rather than first-degree neighbors. I don't want to get into a lot of detail here, but the basic idea is that we parse the sentence using a dependency parser. And then we look for particular patterns such that if, for example, this path here, going from this protein to this protein, goes through a certain verb that we know is indicative of a particular type of interaction, we would score two paths that share that property very highly. So their inner product in that kernel space is going to be high. I mean, at the end of the day, we get very good results, best than anybody else in this task. We actually finished first in the biocreative evaluation, which is one of the main challenges in bioinformatics recently on the protein-protein interaction task. And we submitted the system that is based on transductive SVM using this edit kernel, and received 60% F score, which is higher than what was published before, and higher than anybody else. Question? Absolutely, yes. I'll talk about this in just a second. So we are particularly looking at four different pathways for four particular diseases. So we're part of NCIBI, which is the National Center for Integrative Bioinformatics. It's one of the seven NIH centers for bioinformatics. And our four particular diseases are diabetes type 1, diabetes type 2, bipolar disorder, and prostate cancer. So we're explicitly looking at proteins that interact with each other in the context of those diseases. So here's an example of an evaluation that we get. We start with 20 genes that are reported in the online Mendelian inheritance in Man network, which is a standard database using computational biology, that are known to be related to prostate cancer. So our goal is, by using natural language and network analysis, to identify additional proteins which are not on this list, which potentially can also be associated with that disease. So here's the kind of picture that we get. Again, each node here corresponds to a protein, and two proteins are connected if they appear in the same sentence a certain number of times and they pass our interaction recognition filter. And you can see here that some of the proteins that are well known, for example, BRCA, AR, appear as hubs. They interact with quite a lot of different proteins in this particular disease network. So our evaluation consists of the following. We see the system with the 20 genes that you saw on the previous page, and then we compute the LexRank scores of all the nodes that are not part of the original seed list, and then rank it by LexRank score, and then evaluate it by looking at which additional proteins we come up with which are known or are candidates for being associated with that disease. Okay, so some examples of sentences, I'll skip that. So here's our most recent evaluation. We get six seed genes on the list of output that we get. And some of them are known from other databases to be associated with that disease, from the gene ontology, for example. Some are known from the PubMed database. And then the ones that say no, we send off to the biologist for future evaluation. Question, yes? That's exactly what we're doing. Okay, so our goal is to find in text interactions which can be validated in the lab or in using biological experiments. Okay, so this is the front end of our system. I mean, it's active on the web. We have four networks for each of the diseases. And essentially, the way you see it, similar, actually, again, I want to refer to Andrew's examples here. In his case, you have people that publish papers with each other. Here, instead of people, we have proteins. So this protein appears in this particular cell and is shown to interact with this other protein. So this is the same as McCullough 2007 citing Blay 2003. And you have all the first degree neighbors here listed. Then you can also look at all the second degree neighbors. You can also measure the local degree, the number of neighbors that you have, the clustering coefficient, and so on and so forth. You can also see what other networks this protein could be part of. And finally, you can connect to external databases. Okay, so these are the other three types of networks that we are working on. Questions?
So, in gene interaction networks, are you only concerned about the patterns occurring in the networks or the meaning of the
context? If I understand the question correctly, our edges correspond to any type of interaction. For example, it could be phosphorylation or some other particular type of interaction. We're not so much interested in the semantics of the actual interaction, as long as they're part of the same pathway directly connected through some interaction. Okay, now let's move on to the next part of the talk, properties of lexical networks. So I showed you an example of a dependency network, and one thing that you would expect to see in a talk on this topic is the equivalent sized random network. You know, this is what people usually show when you want to compare, when you want to claim that a certain network is smaller. So what you do is you produce a graph with the exact same number of edges and nodes, roughly the same, using the Erdős-Reinyi random graph expansion model. And you notice that there's a big difference between the two in the sense that a real one contains a lot of hubs and it has a relatively smaller diameter and average shortest path between nodes, whereas the random one typically has a larger diameter and average shortest path, but more significantly, a much smaller clustering coefficient. The clustering coefficient is just the local transitivity of the graph. Just to give an idea, if you have A connected to B, B connected to C, in a transitive graph, you expect also A to be connected to C. So the ratio of triangles, fully completed triangles over the open triangles, is called the clustering coefficient. Ranges from 0 to 1, and it's typically very high, let's say 0.2, 0.3, and higher in small world networks. And it can be on the order of 10 to the minus 4th power for random networks. Yeah, Phil has a question.
Yes, yeah, so the clustering coefficient is higher in the small world, but the diameter is about the same.
Yeah, that's what I said. The difference in diameters is usually not that significant. What really makes the difference is the difference in clustering coefficient. It's going to be 4 orders of magnitude. Okay, so again, there are many different properties that people can use. The average shortest path, the average and longest shortest path, and so on. Okay, I'll skip this slide here, which I assume most people in the audience would know the main difference between the different types of networks. So random ones have Poisson distribution with very characteristic value k, where small world networks have a decaying distribution like this. When the power log distribution is typically, if you put this in a log-log scale, you get a slope between negative 2 and negative 3, which is again can be proven using many different models, such as preferential attachment, which gives the upper bound of 3, and so on, to be typical of this kind of networks. And this is for the dependency graph, the exact same numbers of n and m, not quite actually, because the stochastic process. And the diameter, in fact, changes a lot in this particular example, from 13 to 21, still less than an order of magnitude, whereas the clustering coefficient changes 2 orders of magnitude and more. And obviously, the random graph is not a power law distributed, whereas the actual one is, and it has a very typical slope of 2.19. Yes? Yes, people have done this a lot. You're right. So Mark Newman had the paper a couple of years ago when you want to generate graphs with a very particular sequence of degrees. Yeah, we have done this kind of analysis as well, but most people are not familiar with those. So I don't have slide to show that. But again, even when you compare to this kind of model, you get parallel behavior and small world behavior.
Yeah,
question?
I'm just saying that that would give you
We have definitely done that. Remember, Mark Newman is at Michigan, so we talk a lot about it. Okay, so there are many other examples where you have small word properties in lexical language. For example, thesaurus, where letter is a synonym of character, which is also a synonym of action. So by virtue of a small number of polysemous words, the diameter of this graph becomes very small. Again, this has also been shown on co-occurrence networks, where two words appear in the same sentence in the mental lexicon. When you ask, given a cue with a certain word, what other words you come up with automatically, and so on. Okay, so let me now show you what experimental data we use for our papers. We have a huge database of networks of two kinds. One is what we call latent networks, and the latent networks is a lexical network in which cosines are used on the edges. Well, it's why it's called latent, because we can produce projections of that network at different cutoffs, and each of those will have different properties. And the other type are anything else that goes. For example, citation networks, co-occurrence networks, and so on. Those that don't depend on a particular parameter. And there's some examples that fall kind of in the middle. For example, the Eurovision dataset shows you. It's a little bit of background. The Eurovision contest is a popularity contest of songs in Europe. Each country is allowed to enter one participant, and then each country votes for each other country, and then the country that wins the most numbers wins the contest. So you have historical data that say, for example, in 1982, the Netherlands gave 3 votes to Malta, you know, that sort of thing. So again, you have some sort of a temperature similar kind of cutoff, where if you set the cutoff to 4 votes or less, or 4 votes or more, you would get a different structure of the graph and see who votes for whom. They're typically well-known patterns. This is not my work, but showing, for example, that Ireland and Britain typically vote for each other and so on, whereas other neighbors don't vote for each other and so on. So here's the next 8 slides have 8 examples of the networks that we are currently studying. This one is from a blog corpus. We have, thanks to our colleagues here at UCLA in the database group, we have access to a large collection of hundreds of thousands of blogs as they appear on a daily basis. We also have built some tools which let us, for example, search for a particular query. For example, the Dick Cheney hunting incident is the one that we use here. And we're trying to retrieve all the headlines that are associated with that particular event. Another one is the Columbia disaster. Any type of event, we can get all the documents that are related to it. And we're interested in the structure of the network of headlines. So, for example, here you have, they shoot Republicans, don't they? And again, there's some other words that appear together in the same topic, in the same words. Another example is from the query log that was released last year, almost inadvertently, by our colleagues at America Online. They released a large network of, I don't know, maybe 100 million queries, which did not include personal data, but smart sleuths were able to figure out a lot of personal information just by the type of queries that people asked. So they would search for their own name, and then they would immediately start searching for, let's say, a treatment for a particular disease. And this is exactly the kind of thing that you don't want to make available. Anyway, this corpus is released, and as long as you make sure that you don't disclose any private information. People have been using it for research purposes. And in this particular case, we're interested in, again, a lexical network where you have user queries, so car crash, and all of its neighbors that share a certain number of words, so with high cosine. So car crash, car rental, Carolina rental, fishing, trapping, I don't know what that means. And the idea is that we want to use this to improve information retrieval in the following way. When a user types in a query like car crash, we can mine the neighboring queries and the documents that were returned by the search engine as relevant to those queries to suggest ways to rephrase that query. So if they type something like car rental, I mean, come on, car rental is a very general query. We may be able to suggest, for example, some names of companies or locations and some other keywords. So this is the protein network that I showed you earlier for prostate cancer. Now, this thing here is from another project that we have that is based on, that is, whose goal is to identify the most important writers in the computational linguistics community on a particular topic, such as dependency parsing or graphical models. So this example here is from machine translation, Chinese machine translation, in fact. And again, we have the titles of the papers, and then papers are connected based on the similarity. Another example is chemical elements that appear together in encyclopedia entries. And you can see here when you do some sort of clustering that very clearly some elements that go together would be. So those are all the ones, for example, that transuranian elements that don't have real names yet. So like 1-1 element 113 and 115, cesium and francium are connected and so on. And again, so similarly here you have groups that belong together. This is the political science network. This is one where we're trying to summarize a scientific paper by looking at all the citing sentences that go towards that paper and try to see if there's any sort of consensus. Let me give an example. You can have 100 sentences citing the same paper, but they would cite it for many different reasons. Some would cite it for the methodology, some would critique it, some would criticize it, some would compare their work against it, but most of them would give the actual reason why they're citing. For example, they say Bly and Eng in 2003 introduced latent Dirichlet allocation. So if you can find common themes in those sentences, that gives you another summary of the actual paper that they've been targeting. So this is one of the most cited papers in dependency parsing, perhaps the paper that really started the whole idea of efficient, algorithmically efficient parsing. Was the Jason Eisner paper in 1996, where he found a lower upper bound on the complexity of the parsing algorithm that was previously thought, so less than cubic. And again, if you look at, it's a little harder to see here, the sentences that are the most central are the ones that really talk about his main contributions rather than comparing his work to somebody else's work. Okay, and this is the one from the Turkish, there was a plane crash in Turkey, couple of years ago, and again, it's a little hard because it's way too many nodes here, but the most connected nodes, again, are the ones that give you the center information. Okay, I'll skip this one. So the last thing that I want to talk about, how much, what time is it? Five more minutes, okay.
Yeah.
So I'll show you now some more very recent pictures for which we are trying to get an explanation. So what is, again, a latent network, at least in our description? You have a set of nodes, and then a measure that tells you how similar they are, for example, cosine similarity. So in this case, 7 and 10 are very similar, maybe 0, 0, 0, 1 is their similarity. 0, 0, 2 is the similarity between this cluster. So this is known as a dendrogram in cluster analysis. And obviously, if you raise the threshold high enough, everything will be connected to each other. So obviously, if you look at the graph that corresponds to this cutoff, there will be one node here which has a neighbor, another node that has a neighbor. So two nodes would be here one, and a whole bunch of nodes which have no neighbors. So the degree distribution in that point would be two ones and minus two zeros. If you go to this level here, you would notice a very different behavior. So for example, some nodes will have four neighbors, three neighbors, and so on. If you go all the way up, then everything is connected to everything, where everything is disconnected from everything in the other extreme. So again, you don't have any interesting structure. So we're interested at what point do we have this sort of phase transition where this small world or power law distribution appears. Let me show you some examples. We did simulations using a generating model that looks like.
Can I just ask why
yes.
You would care at the point, who cares if it's power law?
Okay, so here's the main motivation that we're trying to figure out. I want to give you a collection of randomly generated documents. And I want to give you a collection of real documents on the same topic. Can you tell which one is which? So typically when people generate documents, as you would know, you use some sort of an assumption on the frequencies of the word. So typically people use Zipf-ian distribution, where the highest frequency word has a frequency, let's say F, and the next one has F over 2, F over 3, and so on. And some of the frequencies adds up to the size of all the words in the collection. So if you sample producing new documents using the Zipf-ian distribution, you're going to produce a new cluster, and then you measure the cosine similarities between the different pairs, and you try to plot them, and you see if the two graphs look alike. So we're looking for some properties of those graphs, which to help us tell apart the real network from the artificially generated one. Let me show you some examples. So in all of those examples, the cutoff is shown here. So zero, if the cutoff is zero, that means that we look only at edges that have zero cosine or less. And at one, we look at all the possible connections. And as you can expect, the different properties change as a function of this parameter here. So I say that this is similar to the situation where you have people in a small town. When it's really, really cold, people just talk with the members of the immediate family. They don't leave their house. When the temperature starts to rise, you start talking with your neighbors. And then when it's really, really warm, you have a barbecue on the plaza. So that's when everybody's connected to everybody. So the question is, at what point is this social network of people talking to each other a small world network? And obviously, it's not a small world at either end. So it's somewhere in the middle. OK, so here's some pictures. So one of the examples is the cosine distribution itself. So this is the cosine distribution in the real graph. So this is what this is telling you, that there are this many pairs that have a cosine of zero and so on. And then you have some sort of a jagged edge of representation at the end. This is the simulated version. And some other interesting properties. For example, this is actually the one that is probably most interesting to see. The cosine threshold here ranges from 0 to 1. And the degree distribution is plotted right to left for a particular cutoff. So at the very beginning, here we have those very purple color. You have a degree distribution that is very, very flat. At the end, here you have a distribution that is almost nobody has any neighbors. And then in the middle is when you get those nice curves. And then we have actually done a fit using one of Mark Newman's algorithms for fitting power laws. And it gives us an R square that goes as a function from 0 to 1. I don't have a slide for this, but it pretty much shows you that between 0 and 0.2, you don't have enough evidence to support the small world hypothesis. So that's when, in practice, the phase transition occurs, about 0.2, 0.25. And that doesn't depend on the underlying data set. OK, so here's some pictures again that show the real and the simulated version. So the real one, here, this is the number of nodes that you get at the particular threshold by removing all the singletons. This is the simulated one. This is the average shortest path as a function of the threshold. And here you can see a much cleaner transition. So you have a high average shortest path, 4 or 5. And then when you reach a point of saturation here, 0.5, immediately the graph becomes disconnected. So one of the interesting things that we're looking for is why is there such a difference on the average shortest path diagram between the two pictures, and then which we don't have in the other ones. So here, the biggest difference is that this occurs much earlier for the real networks as opposed to the simulated ones. So I think that this has to do with the fact that in real life, you have additional dependencies between the topics. For example, some hidden documents, some hidden topic that unites two documents, even if they don't use the exact same vocabulary. That's why the average shortest path is still, it goes much faster to zero relative to the simulator. By the way, I didn't explain how I did the actual simulation. I have a slide that's probably out of order here. So this is how we do it. We have a set of number of documents, D. The vocabulary size is V, and the frequency of the vocabulary is distributed according to zip. And then each document has W, which is the size of the words in the document. And we have two models, one in which W is a constant, and one in which W follows the distribution of lengths of documents in the real data set. And then you can do some derivations and show, for example, the expected number of documents with one or more occurrences of such and such word, and also the distribution of cosine. I want to show you one more thing.
Sorry, can you stop there for a second?
Yeah.
So now, so the two plots on the bottom, in one you use
which bottom here?
Yeah. In one you use the simulation just describing. No. Stay there. On the bottom, the distribution of cosines across pairs.
Yeah.
And in one case that's the real data, and in the other case.
Yeah. So every time the left-hand column is the real data, and the simulation is on the right-hand side. And this is particularly the cosine distribution
Using
the Zipf'ian assumption. This is the number of pairs of cosine,
yeah, yeah.
0, 0.1, all the way to 1.
So it looks very good. It looks very similar. I mean, it looks like the simulation captures the distribution of
cosines. Exactly. So we capture the distribution of cosine simulated, but we don't capture the average shortest path changes. That's what we're trying to figure out.
This is very surprising to me. We can talk more offline.
Yeah.
I found something very different. I mean, in all the data sets that we have, we were not able to reproduce the results.
Okay. Well, we should definitely talk.
This is which data set?
Okay. I'm showing you actually two sets of pictures here. The first set, which are actually almost the same in terms of qualitative differences. The first one is the set of all the headlines from the blog about the Cheney hunting incident. And the second one, that one has, I actually don't know how many nodes, it's several thousand nodes, in fact. And the second one has on the order of 10,000 nodes. This is the ACL ontology network. All the papers published in computational linguistics in the last 30 years, they're titles.
Okay.
So the cosine simulated has been titled.
These are very short documents.
Yeah, exactly. So that's very short, exactly. We talked about this with you a couple of years ago, and when on long documents you get just way too much noise. So we've been focusing mostly on abstracts. We actually did a similar study of all this Santa Fe Institute papers. Only the abstracts of the Santa Fe Institute papers. And we get also the same kind of behavior. If you look at the full papers, you no longer get that. So maybe that's what you're observing.
Yeah.
And the shorter you get, the more pronounced that effect is.
Okay,
so I'm about to conclude. So I had some derivations here, I don't want to get into this. So just one of the interesting things that we are looking at right now is machine translation using similar network analysis techniques where you have a parallel corpus, so sentences 1 to 6 are in both, let's say, French and English from the Canadian parliamentary proceeding. And you look for words that appear, for example, in document 1, 2, and 3 on the French side, but in 2 and 3 on the opposite side. And again, using random books, we try to find what's the most likely translation of the word Premier Ministre, which is the Prime Minister in Canada, but in the English language document, sometimes it's translated different. So here's that example. Incendie in French means a fire of the kind that is like in building or like in the forest, whereas in the English word fire also includes a fire in the chimney or in the oven or something like that. So the English word has more senses than the French one, and you won't be able to capture this using the graph model. So I'm about to finish a little bit of funding, NSF, NIH funding. We're distributing the software for free, open source, on clarelib.org, all the visualization, network analysis software is there. This is what it looks like. It has a lot of functionality. There's even more than this. That's the end.